It comes as no surprise to me. I am my own worst enemy. That's Lit, first song I ever learned on guitar. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus, the Toronto Blue Jays. Absolutely their own worst enemy yesterday in a 7-6 walk-off loss to the Boston Red Sox. That was a loss that saw them get out to a 6-2 lead initially. A 5-run seventh inning involved some catcher interference, some actual hit and run to manufacture runs, the benefit of an error on the side of the Red Sox, and Vlad hitting the longest home run of his career, 471 feet estimated. It landed on the far side of a parking garage on the other side of Fenway. It felt good for a moment. And then the Blue Jays had a very, very, very bad eighth and ninth inning that included Addison Barger and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa miscommunicating on a pop-up in between third and short that resulted in a runner on second. It included Kevin Kiermaier, who has won Gold Gloves and rates as one of the best defensive center fielders in baseball, getting a poor jump on a ball, breaking kind of in the wrong direction, initially not being able to make up that ground for another one that drops in there. It involves Spencer Horwitz double clutching a ball at second base that led to an infield single. It involved a balk. It involved just a whole mess of things. Some managerial decisions that you could understand, you could pick apart as you can with all of these things. We tend to call it based on the results, not call it in the air. Regardless, very, very bad Blue Jays game. That is their seventh loss in a row. They have not lost more than seven in a row since 2009. So we are looking at, recent history tonight if the Blue Jays don't get it done. John Schneider saying after the game, this game is cruel. This game can really beat you up. It can punch you. This last week has been not quite a punch, more like, Uncle Howdy and the Wyatt Six taking out the entire Blue Jays organization. Sure, great that the team isn't quitting and all of those things. But not a good spot for the Blue Jays to be in here. And it's getting harder and harder to imagine they're able to pull this kind of out of the drain here. They are 16 back in the division, 7.5 back of that final wild card spot that the Red Sox hold. And they would have five additional teams that they'd have to jump on their way. They're not going to throw in the towel yet. It's too early to do exactly that. It's not too early to feel how you feel about it, but it's too early logistically for the Blue Jays to do that. Let's see how Dan Schulman felt about calling that one. He joins us now. He's the voice of the Toronto Blue Jays. Dan, on Zoom. It's so nice to see you.
We'll try and see if I can manage some technology on a Tuesday morning. Let's cross our fingers.
Before we talk about the disaster of a Blue Jays game, how did you manage trying to sneak a peek of the end of game seven after that one wrapped up last night?
I didn't even sneak a peek at all. Damn. During the game, honest. And then I don't know if you've ever been to Boston or been to Fenway. There's no such thing as getting an Uber out of there after. So Mr. Siddle and I, who are two fairly fit middle-aged men, we did a 35-minute walk back to the hotel last night, and I saw the last 6 minutes of the third period in my hotel room. And it was obviously exciting, with Edmonton just swarming around and having chance after chance. And you could just see in the last couple of minutes, like, they were spent. Their main guys had been out on the ice so much. So I wish I had watched more of it. I am one of these Canadians who, with a couple of exceptions, would love to see the Cup come back to Canada, even if it's not the Maple Leafs. And I was pro Oilers in this series, and they authored a very cool story. I'm glad. I know it's not what he wanted, but I'm glad Connor McDavid won the Conn Smythe. I just hope he gets his name on the Cup at some point.
Yeah, there's a moment late in that one when they're trying to, I think the goalie's pulled at this point. He's trying to skate through a couple defenders at mid ice, and he just kind of, weight of that defender, like, he gets out physicaled, but it kind of felt metaphorical for the entire playoff run. Dan, clearly I would rather talk about hockey today than this Toronto Blue Jays team. In the eighth inning last night, as the Red Sox were coming back, you said, I'm misquoting you here, but something along the lines of, the Red Sox have come all the way back. Can you believe it? And Dan, my answer is yes, I can believe it. It's starting to feel like whatever can go wrong is going to go wrong for this team.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate because, as you said just before I came on, people are totally entitled to feel what they feel. They are not mathematically out of it, and it's too soon to pack it in my opinion. But I agree with you. People can feel like they feel. And they, last night was just instance after instance where if something else, like the fork on the road, if they'd gone a different direction at the fork in the road, any one of five or six different times, if the pop-up is caught, You know, Kiermaier usually gets a great jump, catches that ball 99 times out of 100. Maybe if Pearson's fastball is in a different spot to Hamilton, he's much better with his fastball up than down, et cetera, et cetera. To be honest with you, by the time they tied it in the eighth, honestly, I didn't think the Blue Jays, you know, if you had asked me who's going to win the game, I would have said the Red Sox at that point. What happened in the ninth was almost like the inevitable end of what started in the eighth. But I feel for everybody. I feel for the players. I feel for the coaches. I feel for the fans, a tremendous amount who pour their heart and soul into this team night after night after night. I'm sure some of them were watching hockey last night, and maybe that's for the better. But all you can do is lace them up and go play again today. It's the beauty of baseball, and it's the cruelty of baseball that you always get another game to play.
Well, bad news, sports fans. You also don't have hockey or basketball to distract you anymore. And yeah, there are a bunch of drafts this week. The NBA drafts two nights now. We got the NHL draft and stuff like that. But the Olympics, far away. You're like a month away from Paris still, Dan. So now would be the time for the Jays to turn around. You mentioned that you feel for the players and the coaches. John Schneider had some quotes after the game last night about the game being cruel and it can really beat you up. I know you weren't there on the weekend, but being around this team, even just yesterday, can you sense that? Like, is that like, we've talked a couple times about how, you know, the room was holding up pretty well, like guys saying the right thing, doing the right thing. Is that starting to build or manifest at all in your sense?
Right. So like you said, I wasn't there in Cleveland. So the last I saw them was the sweep against Boston. And I will give you the honest truth, what I saw and what I felt. No BS here. And Joe Siddle and I talked about it off the air before the game. We both walked out of the clubhouse. We were down in the clubhouse and on the field for at least an hour yesterday. And on our way back up the elevator to the press box here at Fenway Park, I think Joe turned to me, but we talked about it. And we both said, it feels better than you'd think it would feel. The vibes there. Now, part of it, I do believe, is Horwitz and Barger and Clement and Schneider and Stuart Baroa. All five of them, and I talked about it on the game last night, have lockers in the same part of the clubhouse here. It's right when you walk in. And they're all guys with relatively little major league experience, and they're all, you know, kind of high energy, positive vibe kinds of guys. I think those guys are helping to keep it afloat. Nobody in there, though, is ignoring where they are. And I had some quiet conversations with some of the veteran players about the reality of where they are. They all understand this. I mean, Kevin Gausman said it 3-4 weeks ago, and it's only more of a fact today. If they don't play a lot better really soon, this team is going to get broken up. And if they don't play a lot better really soon, this team should get broken up. To what degree is debatable? But you just can't keep going with this group, and you got older players in the last year of their contracts and that sort of thing. And maybe that's conversation for a month from now. And we are going to talk some Canada basketball today, aren't we?
Of course.
By the way, okay, good, good. I just wanted to make sure it was on the docket. But honestly, I think the vibes are better than you would expect they would be. They're not great. They're realistic, but they're a little bit better, I think, than maybe the average fan on the street would think.
Which is, you know, it's fans maybe, I mean, fans feel how they feel, but the room has no choice but to stay together like that. Like you can't call it now. And even, honestly, even if you could, this is a nice thing about baseball, but also kind of like a cold thing about baseball is even if guys did, like you still individually would want to do really well, and that tends to lead to better baseball as a team as well. And I just kind of realized, Dan, that the Olympics, while you're gone, take place during the trade deadline. So you might miss some chaos there at the end of July.
I might kind of proactively say goodbye to some guys who might not be here when I get back. Yes, I'll be gone over the trade deadline. It is what it is. I'm thrilled to do the Olympics. But yeah, it might be a significantly different group. The deadline's July 30th, and I'm long gone by that point. So by the time I get back on August the 14th or whatever it is, there might be some old faces gone and some new faces there. And, you know, it's interesting, and I know this from fans. I think a lot of fans are just like they've given up, right, on the ability to contend this year. And they just want to rip the Band-Aid off and, like, get to August 1st, or it's actually July 31st. The deadline's the 30th, I think, this year. And just play as many young guys as they can 7 days a week. And I understand that. That is not going to happen tomorrow or today or tomorrow, obviously. We'll see what it is in a month. But, you know, the draft happens during the All-Star break. So the draft is 2.5-3 weeks away. And teams, and you know this, put an incredible amount of energy and time and resources into the draft. And most times the trade market doesn't heat up until after that. So we might, again, hope number one is they play better have some big, long, sustained winning streak, and in a few weeks we're having a different conversation. But if they don't, things might not really get brewing on the trade front until after the All-Star break.
Yeah, the draft is a great consideration there. And then, you know, with the third wild card now, half the league is within two games of a playoff spot. So why wouldn't potential sellers wait until, you know, All-Star break and things like that to kind of crystallize what their direction is. Dan, wanted to talk about a few of the specifics from last night's game. You mentioned, you know, that handful of guys up from Buffalo and how good they've been from an energy perspective and a positivity perspective. Three of them were also involved in pretty tough moments for the Blue Jays last night. So we had Addison Barger combining with Isaiah Kiner-Falefa on that pop-up in the infield that resulted in a Jaren Duran double. We had Spencer Horwitz with the kind of double clutch on the infield single to second base. And then Stuart Baroa, this one's maybe not his fault because that's a call from the bench, but caught stealing on a pseudo pitch out there from a high Kenley Jansen cutter. Some of this could be, and they weren't the only guys, right? Like Kiermaier had his mistake. There was the balk as well. So it's not just on them, but is that to you kind of highlight an inexperience factor? Maybe guys like the fielding version of gripping the bat a little too tight. What did you make of kind of a series of miscues all at once there?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of inexperience. I mean, and I don't know. I don't go down after games and get quotes. When the game is over, my job is done for the night. I talk to guys before the game the next day, and I didn't see any Barger quotes or Horwitz quotes or anything like that. I just saw John Schneider and Guerrero and Bassett, probably the same quotes that you saw. So I hesitate to say what I think it was, but inexperience is possible. Guys, you know, not playing. I mean, Barger's bounced around and he's played a lot of third base. I don't know, and I know you're showing it now. It was windy. It wasn't crazy windy. It wasn't twilight. It was dark. The way he turned at the last second and looked towards Kiner-Falefa, either he was saying, I'm in trouble, you know, with his eyes, or maybe he heard something. I don't know. I will tell you this. I've done so many games at Fenway Park, and stuff happens at Fenway that doesn't happen anywhere else. And I include Yankee Stadium, Wrigley Field, Dodger Stadium, Citizens Bank, anywhere. As soon as you see a play like that, you're going, uh-oh. And it always seems to be the eighth inning, more than the ninth inning, because they've all gone crazy by the time Sweet Caroline plays going to the top of the ninth, and then, boom, the game is over. Wasn't over here because the Red Sox walked it off in the bottom of the ninth, but it seems like the real chaos happens in the eighth. I know Horwitz's play was in the ninth, but I think, you know, it's a combination. It could be inexperience. It could be Fenway. Horwitz still getting used to a position. Kiermaier not getting a good jump. Like, each play is a little bit different and might have a different reason for it. It just, you know, there's just some Murphy's Law going on around this team right now. You know, some of the hits, and I will say this, and I know Tim Mays is not having a good year, and he'd be the first guy to tell you he's not having a good year. He didn't get walloped last night. And if you look back at some of his recent appearances, I mean, it's there have been a lot of hits like the Devers hit last night. And I will say this. I thought Pearson would stay in to face Devers, even if Devers homers off him at 6-5. And then you get Pearson against O'Neill. You know, Meza against O'Neill to me is the matchup that was most frightening. And he was the tying run. He would have represented the tying run no matter what happened. I mean, he hit that ball not great. Like, look at Kiermaier come in. It's not a rocket. I do feel a little bit for Meza. Like, those two hits there, and then the one Zach Pop gave up. I don't know the exit velocities off the top of my head, but none of them were rockets. But it just seems like one team's going good right now and one team's not. And when you're not going good, stuff like this happens. I mean, they do have to play better. I am not absolving this team of what has gone on this year or what's gone on in this 7-game losing streak. They do have to play better. And I'll admit, when Vladdy hit that home run, I thought the game was over. And you know, maybe I shouldn't. Again, like I've said, I've done a million games at Fenway Park and seen this kind of stuff time and time again. But, you know, that Vladdy homer had a chance to be a moment that gets talked about a lot in the future, but now it's a footnote because they lost the game.
Yeah, part of a three-hit game for him, too. He just missed another one for a double off the wall. You know, yeah. I've always thought with Vlad's particular swing and the way he hits the ball, he would hit 70 doubles if he played a season at Fenway. Like, he would just play ping pong with that monster, even in the deeper parts of center. So, Dan, you went into it a little bit there. That John Schneider decision to, and I'm with you, I thought, yes, Devers is really, really tough. You'd prefer a lefty there. We had the Brendan Little example of it last series where Little came in and was able to get Devers in a big spot. You want the lefty-lefty there. But Tyler O'Neill made you pay for leaving a lefty in last time. OPS of like 1,200 against lefties on the season and represented the tying run. So there was that element of it. And then there was the kind of gambit of, well, we're going to shorten Boston's bench and bait a pinch hit here, intentionally walk the guy. That counts as Mesa's third batter, and then we'll go to Zach Pop. That one didn't work out, and you're right. The Romy Gonzalez single was like 76 miles an hour off the bat. Not a particularly well-struck ball. Even if we disagree with Mesa having come in when he did versus letting Pearson go, which we're both on the same page about, were you okay with the, we'll put an extra guy on in a, you know, that's not a bottom of the ninth situation, right? Like, that's not a one run wins the game. That's potentially adding extra runs there. What did you make of that part of the decision to get the Zach Pop?
Totally fine. Fine with that too, because I think they got the matchup they wanted. I think they got Zach Pop against a righty. So the runner they put on at first didn't score in that inning. He was the go-ahead run. The base hit that Pop gave up scored runners from second and third and tied the game. The runner at first, who was, I can't remember, another right-handed bat who came off the bench, Rob Refsnyder, he didn't score in the inning. That's him going to third on the base hit. 100% fine with the intentional walk to get the righty-righty matchup. You know, and going back to Mesa for a bit, Cabrera and Little had both pitched 2 days in a row, Saturday and Sunday. If either one of them is available, because let's be honest, the way they're using Mesa right now is as the third lefty because he's had struggles this year. If one of those other two guys is available, they're probably in the game, and maybe it's a different game. We don't know. Again, Devers didn't hit the ball hard. Mesa got ahead of him 0-2 with two really good pitches, then tried to get him to chase sliders twice, missed, bounced them in down and away, and then ran a fastball in on him at 95, by the way. Like, maybe, I'll have to check, maybe the hardest pitch Tim Mazur's thrown this year, and it jammed him. But Rafael Devers is Rafael Devers, and he hits good pitching, and he flared it into center. That's what I remember anyways. You can fact check all of that, but that's what I remember. It just, you know, the Red Sox made plays, and it didn't turn out well for the Blue Jays. They're dealing with a depleted bullpen right now, too, without Romano and Garcia. And I don't want to use injuries as a crutch because, you know, and I know the Red Sox have had more injuries than the Blue Jays this year. The Blue Jays have a bunch of them right now, but over the course of the season, they haven't had that many. But right now, without Romano and without Garcia, and obviously Eric Swanson is at AAA and Mesa is struggling. So you've got Chad Green closing, and, you know, he's going to do very, very well. He always does. You've got Trevor Richards doing great stuff in his role. But so often it has come down to Pearson and Pop in leverage because of the injuries to Garcia and Romano. And, you know, two out of three times, I'm just making it up, they're great. But they're not right now at the point where they are 100% locked down, consistently great. But they're being used in high leverage situations. And they've both got great potential. And they're the best options the Blue Jays have right now to run out in those situations. And we haven't said Chris Bassett's name yet, and we should. If you want to talk about a professional who is pitching his absolute tail off right now against good teams, time after time after time, Chris Bassett is that guy. I mean, again, another footnote, 7 innings, 2 runs against the Red Sox at Fenway Park on the heels of just seeing them last week, and 6 innings, 2 runs against them there. Chris Bassett deserves you know, more praise than he's probably getting.
Chris Bassett has a 1.73 ERA over his last 4 starts, and the Blue Jays are 0-4 in those 4 starts. He has a 2.36 over his last 10 and has averaged more than 6 innings per start in those 10 starts. And the Blue Jays as a team have gone 4-6 in those games. Bassett is very, very much doing his part to try to steer this out. And you're right, with some of those bullpen decisions, you know, this is kind of, I have it in my notes here, is like, we can nitpick and, you know, hey, should you have done that? You're picking and choosing the spots for Nate Pearson, Tim Mesa, and Zach Pop. You're not picking the spots for Jordan Romano and Jimmy Garcia and last year's version of Tim Mesa. You know, and things get bleak quick outside of this group. Like if someone was knocking on the door at AAA, you know, maybe Mesa's down at this point, but Eric Swanson's ERA is almost 17 at AAA. Hagen Danner's on the IL. Ryan Burr, who we've seen a little bit, just left the game pointing at his forearm the other day for that team. They're trying to start Brandon Eichert now. And anyway, the pitching depth is a mess at AAA as well. You're dealing with not great options here. So that's it's a great Bassett note. I'm glad you brought it up. We're going to see Kevin Gausman tonight. And I'm not entirely sure what to make of the season that Gausman's had. He obviously didn't pitch super well against the Red Sox last time, didn't have the best luck with defense behind him. He has, and everyone has good team and bad team splits because good teams hit better than bad teams. Like, that's just the way it is. But Gausman's are very significant this year. He also has pretty significant righty-lefty splits, which the splitter is supposed to help us neutralize. He has, like, bizarrely large, he's way better on the road than at home splits, which are probably just noisy. What do you make of where Kevin Gausman is at right now?
I think it's been hot and cold. He'd be the first guy to tell you that. I think he's been searching for it more this year than certainly he ever has since we've come to know him on a Blue Jay basis, right? I mean, his first year, he just wiped people out. Like, they may as well have called off the at-bat at two strikes his first year, and a lot of his second year, too. If he got you to two strikes, it was over. He's just not quite getting as much chase and as much swing and miss. And again, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'm doing this from feel and eye test, but it sure feels that way, that he's just not getting strike three as easily as he got his first couple of years. I think he's searching for things. He's, you know, kind of going back and forth between I need more four-seamers up or I need more four-seamers down, you know, trying to steal the strike at the knees. He's mixed in a two-seamer on a fairly regular basis now to right-handed batters. He'll throw sliders to righties, and he even has thrown some sliders to lefties, which he never did, I don't think, the first 2 years, and Jaron Duran hit one of them out of the ballpark last week. He only threw four sliders in the game last week. I think two of them were to lefties, and Duran hit one of them out of the ballpark, if I'm not mistaken. I think you can tell how a pitcher is feeling by how much they vary from what we perceive to be their game plan. Like, Trevor Richards is Trevor Richards, right? Now, he's only a two-pitch guy, but it's not like I ever say on the air, boy, you don't see that every day from Trevor Richards. He's going to go out there and do what he does every single time. Same with Chris Bassett, although Bassett's repertoire obviously is exponentially bigger. But I think Gausman is just struggling getting a little bit more chase and a little bit more swing and a miss. And because he's so heavily reliant on two pitches, he does throw more. But if for a starting pitcher, he is unusually reliant, in my opinion, on two pitches. So if something's not quite going right, he's got to adjust more than most.
All right. So to add insult to injury at the game last night, not only are the Red Sox coming back against the Blue Jays and walking it off, but we have to see the Boston Celtics there celebrating and holding the Larry O'Brien trophy. That part was not very enjoyable for me. The one nice part was we got to see O'Shea Brissett with it. Yeah. Did you get a chance to talk to O'Shea at all? Did you see him?
I didn't even know the Celtics were there until they walked out on the field. I guess I was kind of zoned in or zoned out, depending on your point of view. But when we talked about it during the game, I don't know if you were watching.
Yep.
I gave O'Shea a lot. Like, I made O'Shea sound like he was Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown. Like, I really worked it. So you know where my allegiance lies, and that's with Canada basketball and Canadians and all that. So it was really cool. But no, I didn't see him. I didn't know he was there. You don't want to see it. I mean, again, being from Toronto, and I did say on the air, and I don't know how many it is, but over the last 20 years, count up the championships they've had here in Boston. I mean, it's absurd between Celtics and Bruins and Red Sox and Patriots. It's absurd. And the Blue Jays have, in those four sports, the Toronto's had one, right? So, it's a little bit of a tough pill to swallow, but I'm looking ahead, not back. So I was focusing on Brissett and training camp starting this week, and will he make the roster, and who will be on the roster, and all that good stuff that you and I love to text about.
Yeah, so O'Shea Brissett was the 10th Canadian to win the NBA championship, so that's a nice feather for him. But yeah, we've got a couple minutes here before I let you go. We'll talk to you again before Paris, surely, but what do you make of the training camp roster that Canada put out? So training camp begins very shortly here, this week, and then they'll play, they'll do a couple weeks of camp at OVO Center and Gold Ring High Performance Center. They'll go down to the U.S., to Vegas and play the U.S., couple friendlies in France to get geared up and stuff. But the headline item is the roster, the 20 guys plus Shaedon Sharpe and Benedict Mathurin, who will be there but not competing for roster spots. What do you make of the list? What do you make of where we look right now?
thrilled. Thrilled. I was fairly certain Jamal Murray would be there, but until you see his name, you don't know. And truthfully, until we see how he looks and feels and talks once he gets to training camp, you don't know for sure. But the first step is seeing his name on the list. I was thrilled Andrew Nembhard is there. That was the one I was focused on more than anybody else. Whether or not Jamal Murray is there, I think they need Andrew Nembhard on this team. You want to have one more point guard than you ever think you might need if everything goes wrong. And Andrew Nembhard, as I know more intimately from college, but also we saw this year in the playoff run with Indiana. I mean, he's a stellar point guard, and I think he'll thrive in the international game. He was in China in 2019, as you know, didn't play very much, different role. And you know, 4 years from now, 8 years from now, this could be his team or his and Shea's, and then his beyond that. We don't know. So I was thrilled to see him. I love the fact that Sharp and Mathurin, and I'm impressed with your pronunciation. I just say Benedict Mathurin, but I love the fact that Sharp and Mathurin are there because that's a great sign for the future. You know, as always, you worry about size, and they do have seven bigs on the roster. You know, if everybody's healthy, we know Powell and Olynyk are going to be there. Who the next one or two are, I don't know. Is it Alexander, who was there at the World Cup? Is it Edie? Does his NBA team let him play? Is it Cabangeli? Trey Lyles, to me, probably has the inside track. And then I know, and you and I have talked about this, I'm such a big fan of Melvin Ejim as being the 12th man on that roster. But can they fit him in as the 12th man on that roster? You know very well there are some big fellas in other countries. And, you know, Ejim is kind of a tweener, 3-4, very small four, but he brings so much to the room. And he plays well when he's in there. I hope they find a spot for him. But, you know, if you take the seven, quote, locks from the World Cup, and if Murray is there, and if Nembhard is there, and if Wiggins is there, and if another big, whoever it is there, that's 11 already. And I wonder about that 12th spot. But these are much different conversations than we were having a few years ago. So to answer your question, it's a very exciting time for Canada basketball. And I don't want to short sell the women's team either. I'll be doing both at the Olympics. And I can't wait to see the women's team. They scrape their way into the Olympics, but you never know. They could take off once they get there.
Yeah, that'll be like you and I have talked about that. It'll be fun because you got you and Megan McPeak and Nabil Kareem will be on the call, and we'll be doing more than just the Canada game. So if you think back to how the Canadian women qualified, where they're actually sitting there watching another game, hoping for the outcome, you guys could be on a call like that as well. And I'm with you. I hope Melvin Ejim's there. You know, when we play out these roster scenarios, it could come down to who drafts Zach Edey, right? Like that could be Melvin Ejim's spot there. And you know, I hope even if he's not going to be part of the 12, he's one of the alternate. They've mentioned they're going to bring a couple extra bodies to Europe just in case. Again, means so much to the room. You look at that era of Canadian basketball player, the RJs, the Shays, and guys like that. He has meant so much to them from like a big brother kind of role as well. Think it'd be important to have him there. Speaking of Andrew Nembhard, by the way, great interview with him on Hello and Welcome with Alex and Will this week as well. Dan, I got to let you go, man. I've taken up way too much of your time. There are people tweeting at us right now asking you wrestling questions, but I'll save those for off air.
I know. Sometimes I see those tweets from you and Zoobs when I have a promo. And as you know, I know the words on the sheet and nothing more. So I can't be of help there. And I will never be a wrestling broadcaster. I promise you that.
I have one coming up on this Sunday. My little wrestling play-by-play with Smash Wrestling at the Rec Room. I'm going to do a little double dip, Blue Jays, Yankees, and then hop over to the Rec Room to do one. So nice. That's where I'm at. You're the voice of the Blue Jays and Canadian basketball. So I appreciate you taking the time out, Dan.
Anytime, Blake. Talk to you again.
Dan Schulman, voice of the Toronto Blue Jays on Sportsnet. And yes, voice of Canada basketball for the men's and women's tournaments come Olympic time. Cool to see O'Shea Brissett at the game last night. Not great to have it just constantly rubbed in how many championships Boston has won. And we can't even do the thing anymore where the Raptors have won an NBA championship more recently than the Celtics. Maybe they can get back to that too. The NBA draft is this week, by the way, Wednesday and Thursday. We might sprinkle in just a tiny bit of that over the coming days. I don't know. Do you want to talk about the Blue Jays 8-game losing streak for 10 hours this week? I know it's the job, but we might sprinkle in a little something else here and there as we did with the wrestling the last couple of weeks. Right now, we're going to take a break. The rest of the show, we've got some fun stuff lined up. Mike Petriello from MLB.com will join us. Chris Rose is going to join us after the break here. And we got the O-Dog on the show around 11 o'clock. Orlando Hudson, former Toronto Blue Jay and current player development specialist with the Arizona Diamondbacks, will join us at 11. That's at 11, Chris Rose joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. I am not a good guitar player. I did not learn very many songs before deciding, you know what, sports and skateboarding and plays and stuff like that, that's all enough for me. But Lit, I did learn that one. That's a very easy song to play if you're a beginner guitarist. Mentioned before the break, Orlando Hudson's going to join us around 11 o'clock. We're going to give away some tickets to Jays Yankees this weekend as well. While we wait for Chris Rose here, we do have a good text in the text line from Frankie in Keswick. Thanks for being a man of the people. It's clear they need to retool. If you're the GM, who are you trading and who are you building the core around? Look, there's who you're trading is basically anyone who's not nailed down. So all the guys who are potential free agents, unless you are very, very certain that even if you are certain, there's no rule around like you trade Yusei Kikuchi away and then you immediately re-sign him to whatever the extension would have been agreed upon. So I'm looking Yusei Kikuchi, Danny Jansen, Jimmy Garcia, Trevor Richards. Those are kind of your core free agents. Kevin Kiermaier and Justin Turner would probably have small markets as bench pieces. You maybe have to eat some of the salary if you want a good prospect back, or potentially you just get out of the salary period and then, you roll that money into next year's budget or whatever. The guys where it gets interesting is the guys with multiple years left on their contract. Now, in terms of what I would do, that is a different question than what this front office will actually do. We continue to hear, and the logic makes sense that if they sell, it's not going to be the tear it down, blow it up, sell everyone, and look at 2028, 2029. It's first of all, the farm system's so far away. Second of all, all the Rogers Center renovations, they've got 40,000 seats to fill, all the premium suites. But mostly when you are a big budget team, you don't have to do the tear it down and rebuild all the way. You look around the teams that are successful in Major League Baseball, and some of them have done that. The Baltimore Orioles have like the 1,000th percentile outcome of what tearing it down looks like. But then you have teams like, the Tigers or the Pirates who are kind of in that mode for like a decade before they get back to being, where they are now, which is getting back to relevance. Big money teams can do all of those things at once. Yeah, it'd be great to have the number one pick. The Cleveland Guardians right now are at the top of the AL Central and have the number one pick in the upcoming draft. But they didn't have to, trade away Jose Ramirez to make all that happen. You can do both, especially if you're a bigger budget team, a bigger market team like the Blue Jays are. So anyone who is a pending free agent, certainly on the table, would probably explore, at least see what the market is for some of the veteran pitchers, just because in a seller's market, you've got to at least explore that. But it's hard to see a scenario where it wouldn't be just selling really, really low on any of the longer-term position player pieces, specifically Bo and Vlad. I know that's what people are asking about when they ask these questions. Let's see what Chris Rose thinks about the state of the Jays. He is the host of Baseball Today with Trevor Plouffe, the Chris Rose rotation over at JM Baseball. All-around good guy. Chris Rose, thanks for joining us, man. How you doing?
Great, Blake. How are you?
I am good. Thank you for doing this. Great hat you've got on there. Twisting it in on us after sweep there. A little bit. So yeah, let's start with the Blue Jays, since this is a Toronto show and all. You've got a high level look at them. I know this is a team that you probably figured we'd be talking about in the wild card race. They're pretty far out of it here. What do you make of this start for the Blue Jays?
More than just wild card talk, because somebody that's on the show right now had them going all the way to the World Series before the season started. Hi.
Oops.
That's me. I'm really good at this because I nailed it. Last year, I had Alek Manoah winning the AL Cy Young Award. So basically what you're going to do, don't listen to what I'm saying. Go the opposite way. But this is my feeling here. I am as shocked as anybody that this is exactly where the Blue Jays are. I thought that they had a lot going for them talent-wise going into the year. There weren't a lot of teams that I would say was more talented in the American League and perhaps in all of baseball. So what do you do? I was just listening to you about saying, well, you don't have to do a full teardown. Well, here's the problem, Blake, in my opinion. The guys you've got as pending free agents are Kikuchi, who I think will move in a second. but he's not a true what we call difference maker. He's more of an innings eater than anything else. He's probably slightly above an innings eater is what I'd call him. Danny Jansen's a free agent. Okay, you know, maybe there's some teams out there that'll look at him behind the dish. Kiermaier, Justin Turner, those are guys that haven't had very good years. And, you know, I think there would be people banking on Justin Turner just kind of shaking off a bad first half, and I could certainly buy that. But then you talked about guys like, you didn't mention him by name, but Chris Bassett, Kevin Gausman. Those are guys that would bring you back significant pieces. I mean, I think Bassett would bring you back something substantial.
Yeah.
I know he's making $22 million next year, but he's pitched extremely well the last 6 weeks. And there aren't that many arms available. I mean, Jesus Luzardo, who's been talked about being moved by the Marlins, he's done. You won't see him until mid-August at the earliest, so he's not going to get traded. So who does that leave left? We keep hearing Garrett Crochet's name of the White Sox, Jack Flaherty of the Tigers. There's a few guys, but not a ton. So I think that if the Blue Jays, I'm not talking about scrapping everything and starting over, but I think you have to be willing to listen on guys that are more than in just their walk year.
Yeah, it's a tough spot to be in, and you're right. You have to at least listen on those things because, you know, what are you going to do? Not if someone calls on Chris Bassett, like, yeah, you'd have to turn around and spend that $22 million on a new starting pitcher in the offseason. But if they're going to give you a bunch of prospects and you think you can target a starting pitcher in the offseason, I mean, this team is so far away farm system-wise, and it's kind of why I get envious of teams like Cleveland or Milwaukee who are having really good seasons, have good farm systems, and I don't care about the money, but they've done it with way lower budgets than the Blue Jays too. You know, this is kind of, it's frustrating that it is possible to do all of these, to have a good farm system, to build well, to make good trades, to have a competitive major league roster. So you have to listen on all these things because you're very far away right now at the major league level and you're very far away at the minor league level. Before we completely close the book on the Blue Jays, you were optimistic enough to have them in the World Series heading into this year. They are a team that, you know, the names on the paper are still the names on the paper. We mentioned a couple of the starting rotation guys who are still performing very well. They at least have the rotation to build from. Is there anything that you've seen from this team over the first 3 months of the season that makes you think there is a chance of, hey, what the Astros have done the last couple of weeks, what the Red Sox have done the last couple of weeks, just that kind of kick back to life and get the pulse going again? Or have you seen too much at this point?
No. And the reason I say no is because last night was a perfect snapshot of what has gone wrong with the Blue Jays season, right? Like, they had some opportunities early on. They couldn't really bust it open. Then they start getting some runs, and Bassett pitches great. And then they turn it over to their bullpen. And the bullpen has been an unmitigated disaster. I can't tell you. Now, I don't watch every game nine full innings, but I do watch a lot of Blue Jays baseball. And I can't tell you the number of times I've seen two things. Shoddy defense and the bullpen just being all over the place. And the bullpen has been the main sore spot. And so the way you fix that is via trades. Toronto's not going to be adding anything. So if you can't fix your biggest ailment, then you got to pack it in. I know that nobody, that's not what people want to hear. But sometimes you have to, the hardest thing in sports to do is self-evaluate. And I imagine that Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins and everybody else that's the brain trust in the front office is looking and saying, okay, this did not go the way we thought it would. But you can't just sit here on your hands and hope. Like, that's not going to be good enough with this team, and particularly with this bullpen, to get it done. So if those are the facts, then I think you got to listen on virtually everybody. And I heard one other thing you said. You would be selling extremely low on Bo Bichette. I mean, he has, for the last 170 games, right, dating back to last year, he hasn't been good. He's been an average player at best. But Vladdy, totally different story. Now, I understand you do one of two things. You either extend him right now or you get something for him because he is an impact bat. The way he's swinging the bat, I'm not just talking about last night's ball, which is probably still traveling. The guy all year has been hit. His exit velo has been extremely high, all sorts of stuff, right? You could get a lot for him. So decide whether or not you want to extend him or you want to get moving.
Yeah, three home runs in the last four games for Vlad. So after a season where, you know, the contact profile has really been there and has come around, we're starting to see some of that power. And yeah, 471 feet yesterday. That's That one was pretty nasty. Chris, let's turn the page to elsewhere in the American League here. So the Jays were on the wrong side of the Red Sox last night. The Red Sox have kind of done exactly over the last 2 weeks what the Blue Jays were supposed to do, which is go 10-2, pull your season out of the drain, get back in the wild card position. And the Red Sox have done that against Philly, the Yankees, the Blue Jays, and the Reds. So not dregs, right? Like teams that are in the playoff picture or thought they would be. Are you buying on what the Red Sox have been able to do this last little bit? And you know, I know we entered the season with them maybe under new leadership, this was going to be a modest sell year or a figured out year. They look like a team that could maybe make a case to be buyers at the deadline and make a push for this.
Yeah, so actually that's one of the first questions we're asking on our show, Baseball Today, which I'm going to end up doing right after this. Since the two teams played last night, which of the following statements is true? The Red Sox should add at the deadline. The Jays should just sell, or both. For the Red Sox, I think they're so young, they just go with what they've got right now. They've got such a good farm system, and there's a tidal wave of prospects that are coming that I think you just play it out and see how this team can do as is. I really thought that they were in trouble the minute one of our regular co-hosts on the Rose Rotation, Lucas Giolito, blew out in spring training. Like, that was going to be the perfect guy to fill their void, to give them innings, because, listen, Lucas will give up a ton of homers, but he pitches every fifth day. He can give you length, all sorts of stuff. And remember all the pitching that the Red Sox have lost, and that included a late trade of Chris Sale. Like, it didn't look right. They were going to rely on a bunch of guys who hadn't given them any innings, and they have done exceptionally well there. Kenley Jansen has pitched well at the back end, and Jaron Duran is a guy who we'll see in Arlington at the All-Star game that has spark-plugged an offense that is very different than a normal Boston offense. They are athletic. They can run. They can steal bags when they need to, and it's a bunch of guys you just didn't think were going to be doing it at this level, so I applaud them.
Yeah, it's as much as I hate to admit it, it's an entertaining baseball team. They play a fun style. All those stolen bases, all the young guys. Yeah, it is painful to admit that. Elsewhere in the American League standings, we another team that just swept the Blue Jays. It's just the Jays are just Cleveland, Boston lately. Bad sweep on the weekend. Your Guardians are now atop the American League at 50-26. They have nudged just ahead of the Yankees in the overall AL standings. Are you ready at this point? I think, you know, at least here, it seemed like the national conversation about the American League has been, yeah, it's Yankees and Orioles, and then there's kind of a second tier beyond that. Are you ready to put the Guardians in that top tier with the Yankees and the Orioles?
So we answered this question on yesterday's show, and the reason, even though I'm a diehard Guardians fan, just a tad bit hesitant, is because their starting pitching it's been injured. You know, Bieber goes two starts and then he blows out. Gavin Williams, who was a young guy they brought up last year, has not thrown a single pitch all year, although he's getting very close. And then Tristan McKenzie, who has been a fixture near the top of their rotation all year, has really been battling a partially torn UCL and just hasn't been the same guy. I don't know exactly how we've won basically two out of every three games. Stephen Kwan has turned into a monster. Jose Ramirez has had a great year. Canada's finest, Josh Naylor, has been remarkable. And David Fry has kind of come out of nowhere to lead the top part of that offense. But somehow the bullpen has managed to be, I'm not talking about just great, but lockdown dominant. I mean, they did it last night in Baltimore, too. Like, this is a series I was really curious about, because it's one thing when, with all due respect, if you're winning a series against the Jays, a sweep is still a sweep. And Toronto still is extremely talented, but the Baltimore Orioles are really good. And I know they're struggling a bit with the health of their starting rotation. But Cleveland last night went in there without Emmanuel Clase being available because he had pitched so much. And they ended up winning. And I was like, man, this team's just a bunch of dogs, man. And if they can add a starting pitcher, I really think that they can go toe-to-toe with teams in October. The way they play baseball, they play 162 playoff games. That's the mentality they've got. I know it sounds cheesy and cliche, but not every team does that. Like, the way they run the bases, the way they take extra bases, the way they play smart defense, they're going to be around.
And what's taken on a more outsized importance over the year in the playoffs? It's your bullpen, right? And they've got the best and probably deepest one in all of baseball, including another Canadian, Cade Smith. Shout out to Abbotsford. Another Canadian. They've also got Tugboat, the Canadian prospect in the minors, who leads all of the minor leagues in strikeouts. Another Canadian guy. Cleveland just cleaning up going across Lake Erie there.
It's the pipeline, folks. It's the pipeline. I just let them all stay at my old house where I grew up. And by the way, Cade Smith is a fascinating story. I didn't know a thing about him. And then you hear the story, you know, the background about his dad having emergency surgery and he couldn't, you know, because he wasn't allowed to cross the border. He didn't see his family for like a year and a half. And the guy wants to be an eye surgeon. Like, apparently he can't be a surgeon, like any other sort of surgeon, because his hands are too big. I'm not so sure why he qualifies to be an eye surgeon if his hands are the size of a first baseman's mitt. But, you know, I'm not here to answer that question. But the guy seems fascinating, and he is my Clark Kent. He changes it. He goes in that phone booth and puts that cape on and comes out throwing 98 with a wicked slider. Oh, Canada.
Yeah, that's a it's a great go in your hospital scrubs or your I guess the eye doctor wouldn't, I guess my read on it is like an eye doctor would use a machine to do the eye surgery, like you're using a laser or whatever. But it's cool. It's a good story. You mentioned that you're probably going to see Jarren Duran down in Texas for the All-Star weekend. I know John Boy Media, you guys are doing an All-Star party. You did it last year as well. What are you looking forward to? I know we're a little early, but we probably won't talk to you before then. So what are you looking forward to about that weekend?
Well, we all get together and we get tickets in the outfield for Home Run Derby. And that is a blast. So we're able to film that content, and that's always the best stuff. A couple of years ago out here in Los Angeles, Peter Moylan, former major league pitcher, ended up catching, who was it? Was it Alonso or was it somebody else that hit one? And it was a seed right at him. And he ended up catching it. He jumped up, caught it, fell down, stuck his hand up, had the whole bit. So the deal that we do at the Home Run Derby is really fun because it's a good bonding moment for us. But then the content that we get out of it is great. And then on Tuesday, I mean, if you happen to live in Texas or have friends that live in Texas and they don't have tickets to the All-Star game, come hang out with us. Just check out our social media channels where you can get tickets. And it's a really fun day. You know, we do a bunch of our podcasts live. We do some fun trivia shows. And then we just hang out. We drink some beers with people and talk about the game that we love, and we'll watch the All-Star game together, and we stay out of the Texas heat, which is a chore.
My only note or complaint about any of this is you can't be encouraging Austin Hedges to show rear end to get All-Star votes. I don't know about that part of this whole Cleveland and All-Star crossover. That's a little much, Austin Hedges.
Okay, well, you can partially blame me for this because last year when he got traded to Texas, I said at the beginning of the playoffs when I had him on, he's a regular co-host on the Rose Rotation, I said, Hedgie, if you guys win it all, you have to wear assless chaps on the parade route. And he was like, done, Rosie, I'm in. So he ends up, I watched the parade and I was like, I don't see him. So we had him on afterward. And I said, what happened, bro? He goes, dude, I bought him. I had him in my hand and my mom sees him. She goes, what are you doing? He's like, yeah, well, I made a promise. I'm going to wear these during the parade route. And she goes, no, you're not. You are not wearing those. So I get it. Mama Hedges said no, no big deal. Well, then I see the promo that the Guardians put out for Texas, and there's a shot of Hedges with his behind blurred out because he's wearing the chaps. And I texted him. I was like, oh, okay. He goes, hey, man, I'll do anything for the boys. If I have to, I said, okay. Just remember this, that if you bring Cleveland its first baseball title since 1948, I don't care what mom says this time. You've already worn them once in still photography. You're wearing them for live video. And he said, deal.
Yeah, and look, there are going to be a couple Guardians in that All-Star game. Whether Hedges has an impact on the vote or not. Fun backstory there. Chris Rose, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. If we don't talk to you, have a blast down at All-Star with the John Boy Media All-Star Party in Dallas.
You got to blink. And listen, Blue Jays fans, I know it sucks. Believe me, I've had teams where things were expected to go well. My 2019 Browns were supposed to run through the league and they ended up missing the playoffs. So I feel your pain. Hang in there. Keep supporting them and just root for them to do what's right come trade deadline. I know it stinks. You wanted to be buyers, not sellers, but this is the way it goes.
I think the fan base is ready. Chris Rose, thanks so much, man.
Thank you, Blake.
Chris Rose of Baseball Today, alongside Trevor Plouffe, the Chris Rose rotation, and everything else over at JM Baseball, both on Twitter and on YouTube. Also, commentator on the NFL Network as well. We're going to take a break. We come back on the other side. One of the greatest defensive Toronto Blue Jays of all time, one of my favorite players when I was younger, Orlando Hudson, the O-Dog, is going to join us. He's throwing out the first pitch at a Vancouver Canadiens game a little later today. We'll also give you some updates from around the minor leagues and potentially Bo Bichette coming back today. We'll talk to Mike Petriello of MLB.com. We're also going to give you tickets to a Jays-Yankees game this weekend, whether you like it or not. That's what you're doing with your long weekend. Deal with it. Orlando Hudson joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Very, very excited to be joined by our next guest, former Toronto Blue Jay. He's thrown out the first pitch down at the Vancouver Canadiens game later today. It's Orlando Hudson, the O-Dog. Orlando, thank you for doing this. How are you?
Man, I'm great, man. Thanks for having me.
How you feeling about this first pitch? I know you still do a lot of stuff with the Diamondbacks. How's the arm right now?
The arm feels great, man. Hey, I'm sorry. Do y'all get an echo?
Nope, we're all good on our end.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, man, the arm feels great. You know, I throw all the time, and, you know, I still do a lot with the Diamondbacks. Matter of fact, we're here playing the Blue Jays this week for the next 4 or 5 days, so I'll be here to Friday looking at our team and, you know, and get a chance to see what the great talent the Blue Jays have coming through the system also. So, yeah, man, it's good. I can't wait for this evening.
And you get to be out in Vancouver, which is obviously a great town and a great minor league ballpark there. I know Vancouver wasn't an affiliate when you were coming up with the Jays, but you played minor league ball in Medicine Hat. Man, how big a shock was that to you coming from the South in the U.S. to play minor league ball in Medicine Hat?
Man, that's crazy you asked me that. You know, I go from South Carolina to white people over here and black people over here. And then I go to Medicine Hat, and there's no black folks, because my host family told me, they kind of gave me a heads up, because they told me, they said, don't be shocked at what you see or what you think. And I'm like, okay. And we went to the grocery store, and everything just stopped, because they weren't used to seeing black folks. There wasn't no black folks there. In the neighborhood we lived in, doors were open, little kids walking to school, riding their bikes to school, and neighbors just communicating. And I'm like, this is a culture shock. So I immediately called my parents and say, this is probably the only part of the world that I have never seen black folks. I don't think no black folks are here. So, and it was a shock, you know. So it was a blessing, because I had four other African-American guys on the team with me. It was four of us from the South, and one was from California. So we all stuck together. But it was a great time in Medicine Hat, though. Nobody treated us any differently. They supported us, and that was a shock, because back in the South, which, you know, things ain't changed too much now in 2024. So, you know, it was good, though. I mean, I enjoyed my time there, but I was ready to get home.
So you go from the South, you end up in Medicine Hat, and then eventually you end up in Toronto, where there's, you know, everything culturally and diversity wise. What do you remember about that? Like, you got to Toronto still pretty young. I'd imagine it was still a bit of a change from the South, but a little bit more, you know, you find a little bit more in Toronto for yourself.
Man, my boy Shannon Stewart told me, my good friend Shannon Stewart told me, hey, O-Dog, let me tell you something now. When you get to Toronto, it's different from where we from. Because he's from down in Miami, and I'm from South Carolina, so we both from the South, so we pretty much stick to, it's a cultural thing. You stick to your culture, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So he's like, okay, when you get here, it's a melting pot. I never heard of a melting pot, you know what I'm saying? So I'm coming from South Carolina, melting pot, okay. Man, it's Chinese with black guy. It's Japanese with white guy. It's Russian with black guy. It's Jamaicans with white. I'm like, I would never see this at home. This ain't fit to happen at home. So I called my parents and said, hey, Mom and Dad, y'all got to come to the next series. I got to get y'all flight for early, because you got to see what I'm looking at, and nobody caring. Like, this is what God wants us to be, to love each other. But at home, So when they got there, they were like, my dad was like, this ain't right. Because that's what he was used to. You know, he grew up in the 50s and 60s, 70s. So he, like, this ain't the way they're supposed to be. Like, what's going on here? And I'm like, dude, I told you guys. My mom's mouth just dropped like, this is unbelievable. We don't have this down south. But up in a whole other country in Toronto, which is a 2.5-hour flight from us, it's a totally different world. But I was like, man, this is what the Bible said. This is what Jesus is talking about. This is what love is. This is what relationships is. You're supposed to love everybody. Different culture, different background, different skin color. It's all about love anyway, because we all bleed red, and we all supposed to love each other. And then when I leave Toronto and go back home, I'm like, this is two totally different worlds. Totally different world. But I love Toronto. That's my first home in baseball. It raised me in the game of baseball, in the professional game of baseball. I got so much love and respect for that city, for the fans. It was great. They are great. I love that place. I got nothing bad. You can't say anything bad about Toronto. You can't. It's a great place to play baseball. It's a great place to raise a family. And it's unbelievable. It's just cold. Now I can't deal with that part.
Yeah, it's getting warm. It's warm this time of year, though, so we're good right now, Orlando.
You don't need to deal with the 50 degree.
Yeah. Okay, so you come up in 2002, and that team, you know, they changed managers. It wasn't that good a team. But you've got Carlos Delgado there and Vernon Wells and Shannon Stewart and Roy Halladay. What do you remember about that first call-up? That I think it was July 2002. You come up, and the team's not doing that well, but you're looking around, and there's Delgado and your boy Shannon Stewart and Doc Halladay and guys like that.
Well, first of all, man, we should have been competing for that division. What people don't realize is when Dave Stewart had that job as going to be GM at that time, they should have kept it that way. Because people don't realize we had Michael Young, too. He goes on to Texas and just tears it up for the next 15 years. One of the best hitters in the game of baseball. Then we had Chris Carpenter. They gave him away and gave him to St. Louis. He goes and dominate and win like two or three World Series. So we should have been, if Dave Stewart kept that, if they would have kept Dave Stewart, you would have had an unbelievable team. It would have been Toronto Blue Jays, Boston Red Sox, Derek Jeter and the Yankees fighting for the number one spot. It would have been a heck of an American League East. But with the team we had, if we'd have been in any other division, we would have been in first place. But it was so much turnaround between managers and this and that. We were never able to really get on track. And Dave Stewart had everything in order how it was gonna be if he would have got the GM job. But me coming up with Carlos Delgado, I learned a lot. My boy Vernon Wells, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
And my boy Vernon Wells in center field, we both were young. My boy Doc Halladay on the mound, of course we know who he is and what he brings. So I came up in the minor league system with those two guys. They were the year ahead of me, but still yet, those guys, I was saying to myself, we have a chance to do some damage if they keep us all together. But when they got rid of Dave Stewart, man, the whole thing fell apart. It fell apart, man. And I hated it because we had it. We had the nucleus to put 50,000 people in the stands every night from 2002 on. We had that opportunity to get back to the 1992 and 93 Jays. We had that opportunity.
Yeah, it's unfortunate it didn't work out that way. And that team, you look back on those rosters, and like you said, you add in Chris Carpenter and Michael Young, and those rosters look even more loaded. And I think the one year you guys won 86 games, but it was one of those crazy American League East years. It's a tough one. So Orlando, you pretty quickly earned a reputation here as for your defense. I mean, you were very, very popular here generally, but it was the glove, right? Like, you won a gold glove, a lot of highlight reel plays at second base. I know you've credited Brian Butterfield with some of his impact on your defensive game. How, like, is that something that you always knew was going to be like, hey, this is how I'm going to make my name. I'm one of the best defensive second basemen in baseball. Or did you kind of, like, what was that like for you being an ace at that position and kind of finding it right away as a major leaguer?
Well, Dave Stewart told me, I was playing third base a little bit in the minor leagues, and he said, Eduardo, the way you hit, you need to be at second base. You'll fly through the system. He said, because you don't hit for enough power to play third. So with your gap-to-gap power, and you place, if I put you at second base, you'll be in the big leagues within a year and a half. And I'll be doggone. That's what they did. They moved me to second, and they said, it's perfect. There you go. And I was up in the big leagues before you know it. And Jorge Bell, had me in high A, and they wanted to move me to double A. And they were like, no, give him about another couple of weeks down here in high A. Let him keep getting this swing right. And before you know it, I was up triple A, big leagues, and they went off from there. But I credit Brian Butterfield, and because Brian Butterfield showed me a lot of small intricates of my game on the defensive side that was going to help me be more of an explosive player. So hitting wasn't going to be the problem. The problem was going to be, okay, me knowing the major league hitters and how to position myself with the different major league pitchers. See, we know pitchers going to throw curveball, slider, changeup, sometimes a cutter, sometimes a split finger. But when you got different, when you got five different pitchers on the mound that, you know, pitch differently, it's like, okay, now I got to learn to position myself a little more. Now I got to realize, okay, Delgado, he's here for his bat. I got to help cover a lot of his range. And then I had like three or four different shortstops. So it was a little different, but having Brian Butterfield made it that much easier, man.
So
he's the man.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things. And then in addition, so obviously the defense, you know, pretty natural to you. You're obviously doing a lot of learning there and working with Butterfield. And then I remember John Gibbons, who managed you for a couple of years, said, you know, short of maybe Roy Halladay, nobody worked harder than you. Was that just like you and Halladay and Vernon and those guys coming up around the same time? Was that just like what the organization had kind of built culture-wise? Is that just natural to you to try to get to the field every day and outwork everyone?
Well, that was naturally. That came in me ever since I've been a young buck, you know, from a kid, from my dad, my uncles. They always pushed me. You got to work, man. It's not nothing going to be given to you. And that's a Southern thing, too. And I hate to say it, but I got to keep it G with you. You're a black kid. You got to work 10 times harder than anybody else to get what you want. You got to succeed by working. They're not going to give it to you. Yeah, you're going to have to earn it beyond earning it. And that was instilled in me as a young kid. And my granddaddy used to fuss at us. You got to be up before 6 a.m. every single morning. Never let the sun catch you in the bed. Only if you're sick is the reason why you should be in the bed. Anytime after 6 a.m., you're not going to be able to keep a job, you won't be able to keep a family, and you're going to be considered lazy. My granddaddy always said that. So I'm always up early. Even to this day, I'm up 4:30. Even to this day. Whether I'm home in the off season, whether I'm doing spring training with Arizona, I'm up every morning at 4:30 because I got to go get it. Regardless, I don't want to be shortchanged on anything because I still look at it as even though you made it and you succeeded, you ain't done yet. So to me, I still haven't accomplished anything yet because now I'm working with Arizona. I got to get these young bucks' mind right. Because we came close last year to win the World Series, but I want to see these kids win a World Series. I didn't win one, came close a couple of times. But being in this position, I'm still grinding.
Well, that's
you gotta grind to shine.
Yeah, well, I was just about to plug it for you. You got to grind to shine. That's your clothing line. People could check it out at millions.co or the link in your Instagram bio. What's that been like launching a t-shirt and hoodie line?
Man, it's good, man. It's cool. Somebody brought it to my attention and it's been great. You know what I'm saying? I love it. I'm not too much into it. They check that stuff for me because I'm like, I'm just a country boy, man. Be honest with you. I like to fish and hunt. You know what I'm saying? You know, I like to get out, me and the kid, me and my kids, we enjoy nature. We have fun. We spend family time, but it's been great. And I love it. You do have to grind to shine. Nothing's going to be given to you. If you want it, you got to bust your behind to go get it. That's an everyday thing. You know, people think, I made it. I'm here. No, 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 no. Keep climbing. The great ones keep climbing. It never stops.
Orlando, I got a couple lighter questions here for you that I have always been curious about, but I haven't gotten an answer for. How did you end up in the Youngbloods music video for Chop Chop?
Oh, man. My wife at the time, her stepmom knew Sean Pauls, who's the Youngbloods dad, knew his dad really well. And they used my father-in-law limo service in Atlanta a lot. So J-Bo was into baseball. And he was like, man, you know Orlando? He's like, yeah, that's my son-in-law. He's like, what? So he called me. And we started chopping it up. And I said, man, I'm always in Atlanta. You know, that's my second home that I actually live in. You know, Toronto is my second baseball, is my first baseball home, but Atlanta is my second home. And I went, and they're like, man, come be in the video. Come meet us or whatever. So I'm like, okay, I thought they was playing. So I drove up, you know, drove to Atlanta, stayed at the house. They called me over. We went over. And ever since then, man, it's been, bam, it's been on. And they put me in the video, and I brought them to Toronto. And they was with the famous DJ, my homeboy John Jay, DJ John Jay in Toronto. They did some beats and some music together there, and that's how I ended up in the video, and so forth, so be it. There it was.
That's great, man. You used to change up your walk-up music, like, all the time. Like, a lot of guys will stick with their walk-up song for, like, years and years. Was that just, like, you keep it fresh? Hey, there's a new track. I want to mix it up?
Yeah, that's what it was, because I like to keep the South. Remember, I'm in another country now. Mm-hmm. I'm in Toronto. So I wanted to bring that, make sure that South is up there too. So I had to keep my T.I., my Ludacris. You know, I kept my Young Bloods. I kept all that going. You know what I'm saying? I had to keep it going. Had to get that Young Jeezy in there. So I did all that. So that was great, man. So I wanted to bring that South to the great North up there.
Yeah, you were on Much Music before too, weren't you? When you were here?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. It was fun.
Yeah, that's
it was fun.
That's great. Dog, I know when you were in high school, you were not only a very good baseball player, but you were a quarterback and like an all-state basketball player as well. What made you choose baseball?
Well, my dad chose baseball because I wanted to go to the University of South Carolina to play football and baseball. But my dad was like, man, baseball, longevity. Everybody in my family played baseball. And I I'm like, okay, if I'm not going to South Carolina to play football, but I'm not going to stay in college for 3 years. There's no need. I'm going to go to junior college for a year and I'm leaving, you know. But my dad was big on that, man. My uncle, they're like, baseball, 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 baseball. And I'm like, all right, no, ain't no problem. So that's when I stuck with baseball. And, hey, it worked out, you know. It has been a blessing. God blessed me with that talent to have a choice. But I chose baseball, and baseball worked out. It's been a blessing, still a blessing. And now I'm able to go out and bless these young bucks with some knowledge of the game that I learned and still learning. But, yeah, baseball was the reason that, you know, it's a big family thing. And my dad, you know, helped choose that for me.
Orlando, a little more seriously here. I know you've talked in the past about what an honor it was for you to meet Willie Mays during your playing career. We lost Willie Mays last week. Just wanted to give you a minute. You know, what did he mean to you? What did he mean to baseball for you growing up as a Black American who wanted to play baseball?
Well, first of all, let's throw out the baseball part.
Yeah,
you're talking about a legend. First of all. You're talking about a legend, not only forget the talented, unbelievable baseball player he was and how he made fans stand up and clap every time he walked to the plate or walked on the field. We got to go for what he stood for with Blacks. What he went through as an African-American. What he had to endure because of his skin color. What he had to come across to make it to the point where he made it. Being who he is, only not forget that he's a great human being. Only because of his skin color, the things he had to endure and to battle against on a daily basis. We're not talking about once a week and say, okay, we got enough, we made fun of. No. We talking about a daily basis to dominate the Negro Leagues, to come into major leagues. And to dominate a game that Blacks have been playing for forever, and that we weren't supposed to play in. Not only did he take over the limelight, he was the best player on both sides of the baseball. Yeah, you can talk the other great and the Roger Horns being all them. Nah, Willie Mays is that dude. Roger Horn's been those guys. Ty Cobb had just to come to the field and just play baseball. Willie Mays had to fight criticism. Willie Mays had to fight colorism. Willie Mays had to fight being spit upon, being talked about, being ridiculed. This N-word don't belong this. He had to overcome all that and concentrate on playing the game of baseball with men that don't look like me and him. So for him to dominate off the field, then come to the field and dominate, not the best sleeping condition. He can't walk in the training room and ask a white guy, can I get a massage? He can't go to the corner diner and say, can I get a good meal and do this? No, 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 no. You got to fend for yourself. Eat what you're going to eat. But when you get your behind to this field, you better perform. And he did it. He overcame every obstacle like it was nothing. Could I have done that? 100% most likely not. Okay. So for me, it was an honor. It's beyond an honor to be able to shake his hand and look at me in his eye and say, thank you. My thank you wasn't enough from what he's done for me to play this game. That wasn't enough. African-Americans owe this man not only paychecks, but we owe him our life because him. And I can just go on and on. From what they've done for me to be able to stay in five-star hotels, eat at five-star restaurants, play in five-star stadiums, and have white guys who work in the clubhouse to give me a massage for me to play this game that was considered only for white. The Say Hey Kid did that for me. He went through that battle for me. And he went through that battle for Mookie Betts. Mookie Betts is going to pass it along to someone else. So when we look at it, I accomplished what I was able to accomplish. Yes, I was given the talent by God, but I was accomplished because God put Willie Mays in that position. I wouldn't have been able to do that. Ken Griffey probably wouldn't have been able to do that. Tony Gwynn wouldn't have been able to do that. Barry Larkin wouldn't have been able to do that. So those guys before us stood before and stood with their head held high, and they fought on the inside, and they had to suppress their feelings because if they would have came out loud and said so much, Willie Mays would have died by lynching. It wouldn't have been natural causes. He wouldn't have seen 93 years old. So he saw the greater picture. So he knew, okay, I got to bite my tongue, and I got to play this game. Because I got a godson coming up, Barry Bonds, who is the greatest player of all time, coming up. So I'm going to bite my tongue because I got to bear with these people, and I got to play this game. And I got a generation of blacks coming behind me that's going to need my voice right now. So my voice is going to be loud, but it's going to be silent at the same time. And I'm going to know when to speak and when to stand up and when to do it. And nobody had nothing to say because he did it the right way. He didn't go at it angry. He said, I'm a black man that this business is run by 20 major league teams, 20 billionaires or multimillionaires at that time who are now billionaires. I got to know when to pick my battle and fight my battle because I got a full generation coming behind me that's going to need me. And we did. Not did, and we do. Not do, and we're going to in the further generations that play in the game of baseball because of what the Say Hey Kid did for us. He didn't do it for himself. He did it for us. So I thank that king of baseball for what he stood for, stand for, and will remain standing even though he's laid to rest because of what he accomplished and what he did on the field of baseball and beyond baseball, what he accomplished off the field.
Well, Orlando, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I'm really glad you got the chance to meet him and thank him and shake his hand. Really nice tribute from the Giants last night, everyone wearing his jersey number. And they win in a walk-off as part of the night honoring him. Orlando, thank you so much for taking the time out today, man.
Thank you for having me, brother. Thank you so much.
Orlando Hudson, former Toronto Blue Jay, Arizona Diamondback, Los Angeles Dodgers, Chicago White Sox, now with the D-backs as a player development specialist. He'll be throwing out the first pitch at the Vancouver Canadiens game a little later today, one of my all-time favorite Toronto Blue Jays. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to give you some tickets to Jays Yankees this weekend. We're going to talk to Mike Petriello of MLB.com. We're going to let that chat with O-Dog sit in here a little bit as we take a break. Mike Petriello joins us on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Breaking down the top stories in the NHL every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, a little cheek face for our next guest of MLB.com. It's Mike Petriello. Mike, good morning, man. Thanks for doing this. What a cup final you got last night.
Mr. Murphy, well, I didn't get it. My team stopped playing hockey like 2 months ago.
Yeah, same.
That would be the Devils. But listen, once we get to a game seven of a final, of course I'm going to watch that, even though there's so much amazing baseball on. And wasn't the outcome I wanted. I was rooting for the Oilers. I was rooting for Canada. I was rooting for Jamie Campbell. Didn't work out, but it was a pretty fun game.
Yeah, very fun game. And yeah, we're getting pretty used to outcomes we don't want around here these days, at least on the baseball side. Man, another tough one for the Jays. They've lost seven in a row. I know it's still only at the halfway mark here. The season's not done. But when you look and you see 6.5 back of the final wild card spot, you see the second largest home run deficit relative to what they've given up in all of baseball. We've checked in with you on this a couple times throughout the year. Where are you at on this Blue Jays team right now?
They, you know, I don't have the standings in front of me, but I believe they have more wins than what, four teams in baseball, maybe five, something like that.
And three in the AL.
Four of those teams were, yeah, I mean, listen, and the teams they're better than are mostly non-competitive, right? Nobody expected much from Colorado or, you know, Miami. It's not great. Like, they're in a tough division. I like to publish my preseason win projections just so I can go back and kind of judge myself. I had them at 84-78, fourth place. So it's not like I came into this season with these amazingly high hopes that this was a World Series contending team. I had a lot of concerns, and they've sort of underperformed that. I do think maybe we're putting too much into this last week. Like, it's not this bad. They are not one of the five worst teams in baseball. I truly don't believe that. You'll get Bo Bichette back. Some other things will, you know, turn up, but it's getting late early, I guess, is the way I would put it. And I know everybody wants to talk about, will they trade everybody? I don't know, but what have you seen that makes you have a lot of confidence that they're going to find that next gear and run to the playoffs and make that big move? Because I'm sort of struggling here.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, right? Like, you still have four good starting pitchers. You know, Kevin Gausman, we can debate what his season's been like, but you have at least three guys who are really performing every time out there. But your bullpen is in shambles by performance and injury. You know, you've called up some of the Buffalo kids and they've given you a shot, but you're still playing George Springer every single day, who's in the middle of the worst month of his entire career and is having one of the worst offensive seasons we've ever seen for a corner outfielder. I guess, yeah, I mean, maybe there's a little bit of room for optimism with Bo. The fact that Vlad, like, once maybe this was a mental reset for Bo in addition to the physical break. Maybe this was, you know, Vlad's got three home runs in the last four games. Maybe that's starting to come around. But it's hard to see that many things kind of pulling in the right direction at the same time. Mike, what do you make of the George Springer side of this? We saw some warning signs last year, but they were warning signs that, like, oh, he might be like an average bat from here, not he might be the worst qualified hitter in baseball.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. So last year he went 20-20, which is cool, right? And I think that may be obscured to a lot of people that there were some warning signs coming. You know, every year at MLB Network, we rank our top 10 at each position. And for the first time in, I can't remember how long, he didn't make it for me. He was not one of my top 10 right fielders. Again, I did not think he would play as poorly as he has. Nobody could have possibly seen that coming. You know, for all the criticism you may want to put on the front office and the executives and whatever, this was not a foreseeable outcome that Springer would hit this poorly. Because I'm with you. I thought he'd be an average solid bat, you know, your fifth best hitter maybe. What's happened here, it's the decline has just accelerated, right? He's going to be 35 years old. He's had a long and really good career. You know, we shouldn't let this obscure that, both with the Astros and then when he first came to Toronto. He's been a really, really good player. And it's not surprising that as you get, you know, a decade into your career and you turn 35, things maybe slow down a little bit. But it is just really declined a lot faster than I thought. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's the cumulative impact of the injuries he's had over the years. You know, offense is down. We all know that. So maybe that's affecting him maybe a little more disproportionately than everybody else. But I think it's easy to say, you know, don't play him. I think that's not going to fly in the locker room. I think John Schneider did the right thing by taking him out of the leadoff spot. I saw someone complaining that he was hitting cleanup the other day. It's one game. It does not matter. I don't care about that at all. And the fact is, you know, you could argue to not play him if you were going to play Kiermaier and Varsho every day and someone else in right, but Kiermaier's not hitting either. So you can't really argue that he should be playing every day. So you sort of got to ride it out. Like there's only so much John Schneider can do if the players aren't hitting. They've called up guys from the minors. Martinez got suspended. That stinks. Nothing you could do about that. You got to go with what you have. And I just don't know that they have enough.
Yeah, and look, maybe Bo Bichette coming back and getting hot at the same time as well. Maybe the top of the order starts to look a little different. Justin Turner's turned it around. But, like, we're talking about stuff that would get this team back to playing like a 500 team. Not a, like, they got to win at a 100-win pace the rest of the way to get back to, you know, I think they'd have to win at a 97-win pace to get to the win total you projected, about a 100-win pace to get to what projects as the third wildcard spot. And I don't think they have that. Bo is expected to return tonight from injury. I know you had looked at, you know, you had tweeted something about his barrel rate dropping off pretty significantly. You know, Chris Black and I have talked, and I've done this on Blue Jay Central about, you know, how the two strike approach is still there. He's actually still really good with two strikes. It's just the swinging out of his shoes, that bad stuff before two strikes. There's just a lot going on there with Bo. Have you been able to make heads or tails of it?
I don't think anybody has, right? I've looked, I've read a lot of people trying to do it, and I haven't really seen a single compelling answer yet. You know, and his approach has always been kind of streaky, a lot of opposite field hits, and I know that's why a lot of people love him. You know, you can never shift him, you can never defend him, and I think that just makes him prone a little bit to streakiness. Obviously, he's been hurt this year, and I don't have a great answer for what has happened. I'll tell you this, I don't believe that a player who's been as good as he has for this many years has just lost it at this young of an age, right? It's different than Springer. He's, I don't know, what, 7-8 years younger than Springer, if not more. It's different. And, you know, you can always say, well, he's having an off year, things aren't going well, who knows? But I'm not out on Bo Bichette, right? Like, I fully expect that once healthy, he can still be a really good player. And I think that's important because I know everybody's going to want to talk now about trading him or extending him or trading Vladdy or extending him. And I don't think you can wipe away what's been a pretty good career just because the first 3 months of the season have not been that exciting.
Yeah, and look, when it comes to trading Bo or Vlad, you know, you have to also factor in not only, you know, what makes sense directionally for the franchise, what are the ownership's goals and things like that, but also, are you going to get Bo Bichette value for Bo Bichette when he's hitting, I don't know, what was he hitting, but before, yeah, 237 with like a 600 and change OPS. Like, you're probably not getting a Bo Bichette return. So you had tweeted the other day about this kind of Blue Jay situation that, yeah, it's, I think we can all agree that if things keep going as they're going, Kikuchi, Jansen, Garcia, Richards, the guys who are about to be free agents, you know, the vets who could play a bench role on a better team, those guys are going to be available. And then you pointed out you don't have to trade Bo and Vlad, but the interesting name is maybe if you, and you worded this as Gausman, if you're worried the start of the decline is real. Separate of if the Blue Jays should explore that option if someone comes calling, do you believe what we've seen from Kevin Gausman this year is the start of the decline phase for Gausman?
A little bit, but that's not as negative as that sounds, right? People hear decline and you think he's an unpitchable pitcher. I'm certainly not saying that. Over the last, couple of years, he's been a top 8 or 10 starter in baseball, depending on how you want to look at it. Like, he's been ace level. He's been really, really good. I think it's fair to say that those days might be over. I don't think it's fair to say he's not a quality starting pitcher, but it's not also that hard to see what's happening, right? His velocity has been down. We know there was a bunch of issues with the shoulder early on, so I think his four-seamer is still down by a tick, and he's not getting the same movement on his splitter. And we've now talked about all two of his pitches, essentially, right? I know he fools around with some other pitches, but when you're a two-pitch pitcher, I think for many, many years it was thought you can't be a starting pitcher with two pitches. You can't turn the lineup over. And guys like Gausman, guys like Spencer Strider, guys like Rich Hill kind of prove that you could. Right? If those two pitches were of high enough quality, you could totally make it work. The problem is it doesn't leave you a lot of margin for error, right? If either one of those two pitches starts to lose any of its effectiveness, you're kind of in trouble. And like I said, you can look at the four-seamer. It's a little slower, not slow, but slower. You can look at the splitter and say, yeah, the vertical break on that splitter, it's not bad, but it's not as great as it once was. And you can kind of see this is a trend that happened even starting a little bit last year, which I know is surprising to people because he pitched pretty well last year. You could still see it a little bit. I had some reservations about him this year, and I think it's maybe manifested itself not so much in poor performance and just a lot of inconsistency. I know, two starts ago, he looked great, right? Struck out a bunch of guys, but it's been up and down. So I would look at him, you know, not necessarily as a guy who can't be part of your rotation next year, because you'll need starters, and I still think he'll be a good starter next year. But if you're considering maybe where is his value the most, it's not going to go up from here, I don't think. I think if you want to consider moving him, opening up a hole in your rotation for next year, I think maybe now is the time to consider doing that.
Yeah, and look, there's a reason that, you know, some of this is trying to get ahead of the adjustments hitters are going to make, but there's a reason a guy who had so much success with the fastball splitter combo toyed with reintroducing his sinker this year to give him a different look. And that's something that, you know, I'll use that as a pivot point because the Jays are playing the Red Sox right now, and they're going to see Brian Baio tonight. And, you know, we know that Brian Baio is one of the examples of what the Red Sox have done. And I'm not suggesting this for Kevin Gausman. It's purely the pivot. But the Red Sox have basically been like, unless you throw a Nick Pivetta level of quality fastball that is hard and has good ride and you can pinpoint it up in the zone, stop throwing your four-seamer. Throw sinkers, throw cutters, throw both sinkers and cutters. You know, in Baio's case, it's that heavy 96-mile-an-hour sinker that he gets such a good ground ball rate on. You know, elsewhere in that, like the Sox are throwing, I think, only 16% four-seam fastballs, and every other team is like 25% and higher. What have you made of that trend? And I guess, you know, the Red Sox are kind of like, to use a Blue Jays City Connect term, a hyperized version of a league-wide trend where a lot of guys are trying to throw at least two of cutter, four-seam, sinker just to mix up their fastball stuff.
Yeah, for how many years you threw a fastball just because that's what was done, right? You establish your fastball, that's your meat and potatoes, everybody had a fastball. And it's not new for this year, but it's sort of been a trend. Hey, outcomes on four-seam fastballs are worse than everything else. Let's stop throwing those. Let's start throwing more of the bendy stuff. And the Red Sox have really taken it to a new extreme this year. And when I looked into it, I think we're maybe thinking a little bit too much about, you know, not so much the number of fastballs they're throwing, but the kind of fastballs they're throwing. They didn't just go around to everybody on the team and say, hey, no more four-seamers. You're not allowed to throw a four-seamer. As you said, Nick Pivetta has a really, really good four-seamer. He's still throwing it, right? So oversimplifying here by a lot, because there's a lot of measurements that go into this kind of stuff, you know, sequencing and location and arm angle and all this kind of stuff. But if you just look at velocity and you just look at rise, right? If you can throw it hard, you're cool. If you can throw it hard with rise, you are great. And if you can't do those things, don't throw it. Like, don't give the opposition hittable fastballs. Turn that into splitters. Turn it into cutters. Turn it into sweepers. You know, Tanner Houck, who they saw last night, has not thrown a four-seamer this year. He has replaced it with cutters and splitters, and he's still got his sinker slider, and he's become one of the best pitchers in the American League, right? Brian Baio, who last year, I think, had a slugging percentage of like 540 on his four-seamer, has not thrown it this year. He's replacing it with other pitches. So again, it's not don't throw fastballs. It's why are we helping the other team with the bad fastballs? Let's just throw the good fastballs and we'll find other stuff to throw. And they've dropped their ERA by like an entire run.
Yeah, so that's, you know, it's been frustrating to watch from up close because the Red Sox keep beating the Blue Jays, but it's been fascinating to watch. And again, it's kind of a league-wide trend. Jason Stark and Eno Saros had a really good piece at The Athletic this week talking to a lot of players around baseball about the drop in offense and just like how over-leveraged we are on like pitching advancements and things like that. And a part of it is like, yeah, there's no such thing as sitting on a fastball anymore because you have to look at three different types of fastball and they come out of different tunnels and things like that. I mean, go read the article, but this is kind of part of the explanation of league-wide offense being down has to be that, yeah, pitchers get the first mover advantage and they've moved like 37 times before hitters can catch up to those first moves.
Yeah, I think that's right. And some of the quotes from hitters in that article that were really funny, it's like every pitch is nasty now, right? There is nothing where I can be like, oh, thank God this guy's going to throw me that because it's all been optimized. It's all how do we get to the best version of ourselves? And for as much as people love to complain about analytics and data, this is mostly what it is, right? It's, hey, how do we help you improve? Like, how do we help you find the best pitches you can throw? Kevin Gausman's an example of this. For how many years with Baltimore and these other teams, they wouldn't let him throw his two pitches all the time. Now he did, and he got great. But I do think, you know, the article was really interesting, but I think maybe we haven't all caught up with what's going on necessarily because we always like to talk about strikeouts, and I don't think enough people have realized that the strikeout rate has been kind of flat mm-hmm. for the last couple of years. Like it went up for, I don't know, 13 straight seasons or something like that. It hasn't gone up in the last couple of years. We might have reached peak strikeout, and yet the offense is down. And even though people like to talk about the ball not flying as far or whatever, this is still going to be like a top 12 or so home run per 9 year, right? Home runs have not left the game. So what's happening here is it's not about strikeouts. It's not really about home runs. It's about all the other batted balls, right? that they are not finding grass. And I think that's because if you look at the outfield, outfield positioning is elite. It is tremendous. You have guys being positioned basically where the data tells them to be. And I can tell you, if I ran the entire sport, the first thing I would do is I would say, no more positioning cards. Nobody needs that. Get that out of your hat. Coaches can yell at you to move. That's fine. You can study before you go out there. That's fine. But I want to see more batted balls finding grass. I do. Even though you know me, Blake, you know I don't care about batting average that much. I still feel like the batting average leader should be over 300. That's how you got to do it. You got to let some of these balls find grass, and it's not happening right now.
Yeah, and that'll get more doubles back into the game as well. And I just honestly, like, again, I'm going to lose my analytics guy card for this. I think the positioning charts and even the like quarterback wristbands the catchers have makes everyone look like a dork. I don't like it. Like, I like memorize that stuff. It's hand signals. Like, what happened to the, who is it, David Stern, or not, Daniel Stern in Rookie of the Year, where he's got the elaborate signals to call for the stolen base or something like that? Give me that stuff. Don't give me a little card. I know this is like, this is my most old head take, but I hate the cards, the positioning cards.
No, well, listen, Daniel Stern also got trapped between two different hotel room doors.
He did.
So I don't know that I would take his opinion on much of anything, but I can tell you why I like banning this is because there's no cost to the fan, right? People are all angsty about, oh, we made the bases bigger and the shift and all this. Nobody, you can't look at this and say, oh, that changes the game. That meaningfully changes the way I view the game. It doesn't. That would be so easy to do. And just to be clear, I'm spouting my own opinion here. I've heard literally nothing at all about this actually being a thing. This is just what I would do.
Yeah, I think I don't like the way it looks. And I think you should have to, like, you should have to memorize that stuff if you want the advantage of it, or at least be able to signal for it as well. Okay, so you mentioned batting average there and things we could do to juice batting average and maybe a couple extra doubles around baseball. What if everyone just hit like Stephen Kwan and like shortened their swing, slowed down the bat speed, hit 389, hit nothing but line drives. And oh, by the way, started to also hit for power like he did against the Blue Jays these last couple seasons. I know the article's not out yet, but a little teaser on what you have coming on Stephen Kwan.
Yeah, I'm writing it right now, actually, right before we spoke. And when we're done, I'm going to go finish it. So he's hitting 389, I think, right now. Yes. And it's so funny to me how he's doing it. Like, the story everybody wants to talk about is, will he hit 400? No, he will not hit 400. It is not possible. He's not going to do it. But what's so funny to me is you have this guy who, you know, is closest comparable is probably Luis Arraez, right? Like, batting average, contact. He openly this winter spoke about trying to hit for power. He went and said, I need to hit the ball harder. And if you look at his batted ball data, he's not actually hitting it harder. He is hitting it in the air way more. He is pulling it in the air way more. He is kind of gripping it and ripping it on these inside pitches where he used to be satisfied with slapping a single. He's now trying to crush it for power. And what was really interesting to me, so I looked at his leverage splits, right? So leverage just means that how important is the context of the situation, right? Is it bases empty, bases loaded, outs count, you know, all that kind of stuff. He is unclutch in some very funny ways. Like, when it's a high leverage situation, he's not hit that well. When it's low leverage, he's been great. And I don't say that to mean I think he's not, you know, clutch or doesn't have guts or whatever you want to say. His approach has changed. He's going back to old Stephen Kwan in these big spots because he's just trying to get the single, which I get totally. Don't care about exit velocity. You just need to get that run on the board. Totally understood. But he's crushing it in these other situations because he's going into his new, I have such amazing bat control, I can pop it to right field. And he's not hitting it harder. I don't think he's swinging harder because there was never, ever a version of this where a man with his body type was going to be Vlad Jr. or Aaron Judge. Like, this was not going to happen. He has such amazing bat control that he actually has this ability to say, well, yeah, I can pop some home runs and I don't care about batting average goes down. And it hasn't, because he's amazing. But it's so funny to me that the story is not batting average for him. It's, I'm trying to hit tanks and it's working.
Yeah, I mean, it's, some of those line drives become fly balls and they leave the park. Some of those ground balls become line drives and they drop in for an even higher batting average. Line drives are good. Line drives are great. And my favorite Stephen Kwan stat is he had the lowest swing and miss rate in all of baseball last year, like how often he whiffed. And he has cut that in half this year. Just ridiculous. Last one quickly before I let you go here, Mike, because I got some tickets to give away before the show ends. You had a piece just go up right before we came on potential trade landing spots for Luis Robert Jr. I imagine if the Jays were 6 or 7 games better in the standings, they would have been on this list as well. But what are you looking for in the Luis Robert Jr. market?
Yeah, real quick, they don't have to trade him because he's not a free agent and he's not necessarily having a great year. But my point is, I think they might, because outfield across baseball is just atrociously bad right now. It's like the lowest performing outfield in terms of hitting in baseball history. Sort of it's fluky, sort of it's Harper and Betts are infielders, Acuna's hurt, Trout's hurt. So there's a lot of reasons, but there are teams, contending teams, who desperately need an outfielder and won't be able to find one. So I came up with a list of 10 teams where if you might want to get Robert, not just for this year, but for future years. And I got to tell you, I cannot find a better fit of player and team and need than the Phillies, because I think the Phillies are up there with the Orioles as the best team in baseball, and their outfield is straight up bad. It's not good. Johan Rojas was their center fielder, got sent back down. Castellanos has been not great. Whit Merrifield has been not great. They desperately need an outfielder. And if you add someone like Robert to that lineup, and he's sitting around Harper and Schwarber and Trey Turner, that is going to be the World Series favorite. And I'll tell you this, Dave Dombrowski, who's running that team, has never shown fear to go make the big move. That is how he has made his career. And it's perfect for me if the White Sox want to trade him, which we don't know that they will.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really, really the White Sox and the Rockies are the two teams that's like, how could we possibly know what you're doing? Because nothing really follows the rules of that's like econ 101. It's like, let's assume everyone's a rational actor and then all economic policy flows from there. It's like baseball 101 is let's assume a rational general manager. And then the White Sox and Rockies, you got to throw it out. Looking forward to reading that piece. So, Mike, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning.
Blake, thanks very much. Talk to you soon.
Mike Petriello of MLB.com. of Blue Jay Central had a nice thing last night on Blue Jay Central as well. In addition to talking about how the Red Sox have ditched fastballs, but about how the Blue Jays are, even against the defense as bad as the Red Sox have a pretty poor infield defense. The Blue Jays are just like the worst team in the league at turning ground balls into hits, which is especially notable on nights where the Red Sox ground balls or even their pop-ups in the infield are going for hits, some of them extra bases. Things will maybe be this better this weekend at home against the New York Yankees. I can't promise that from a results perspective, but I can say that the Blue Jays will be at home. It's Canada Day weekend, which is always a blast down at the park. Some of the days look like they're going to have nice weather. So let's send you. The Blue Jays return home this Thursday for Canada Day long weekend to lead off their final homestand before the All-Star break with matchups against the Yankees and the Astros. To help kick this off, we're giving away a pair of tickets to Friday's game against the Yankees. That's the 28th. To enter for a chance to win, text today's code word summer to 590-590. Again, today's code word is summer, as in Seth's girlfriend from the OC. Text that into 590-590 right now to enter for your chance to win tickets to the game on Friday, June 28th. We have one last pair of tickets to give away tomorrow, so make sure you tune in for that. Will the Blue Jays be on their longest losing streak since 2009? When those games happen, we'll see. They could do that with a loss tonight against the Red Sox. The Jays have lost seven in a row. They have not lost more than that again since 2009. That's we're going back a long, long time. Like, I didn't live in the city. I was, you don't even know what I was doing in 2009, but it's been a long time since the Blue Jays had a losing streak longer than the one they're currently on. And oh, by the way, they weren't supposed to be competing for a World Series the last time they went on a run this bad anyway. We're expecting Bo Bichette to return from the IL tonight. He had a good pregame workout yesterday, according to Arden Zwelling. So we'll see. I'd imagine Stuart Baroa will be the corresponding move. They've used him as a pinch runner the last two games. But, you know, Addison Barger shifts to the outfield a little bit more, as maybe he should. And then Bo Bichette slots back into shortstop. IKF plays a little bit more third base. That's probably how it shakes out there. Jose Kwas, who the Blue Jays had claimed off the waivers from the Cubs and sent to AAA, was with the team yesterday on the taxi squad. Given how much they've had to use the bullpen, maybe you see one of those churn the bullpen moves for a fresh arm in there. Maybe they hold off on doing that until tomorrow, so they have an extra arm behind Yoriel Rodriguez in the season finale. Jimmy Garcia threw up to 120 feet yesterday. Jordan Romano was back to playing catch from 75 feet yesterday, so maybe some disaster avoided there with his elbow being sore again. Down on the farm, Ryan Burr is potentially hurt. Yosef Zulueta got called up by the Reds. If you remember him, he got DFA'd at the start of the season here. He'll make his Major League debut soon. And then James Kaprielian, who the Jays signed for additional AAA depth, made a rehab start in the Florida Complex League yesterday as well. We're expecting Joey Votto back in Florida Complex League games later this week too. It is Kevin Gausman against Brian Baio tonight. You just saw both of these guys. Baio gave up 2/6 against the Jays. A lot of ground ball stuff, heavy on the sinker. It's like 95, 96. He throws it about 40% of the time. With two strikes, he will throw his sinker, his slider, and his changeup almost evenly. So if you get the two strikes, good luck against Brian Bayo. On the Gausman side, we're looking to see him turn those splits around, both righty-lefty, home road, and good teams at bad teams. We'll talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break this one down.